West Ham versus Brighton, draw and under 2.5 goals, incorrect. Ended up being a 3-3 special. Spurs versus Manchester City, draw and over 2.5 goals, incorrect. Leicester versus Chelsea, draw and over 2.5 goals, correct. Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of the Squawker Talker Football Podcast, sponsored by BetBull. As you all know, or may not know, if you're a first-time listener, the predictions that I mentioned at the beginning are BetBull accumulator for last round of Premier League fixtures. Two incorrect, one correct, so I'll introduce the man returning after a triumphant prediction, Chief Writer at Squawker, Mohammed Butt. Welcome.
Can't go wrong with a 2-2, Jake.
Oh, is that what the over 2.5 was based on? Because obviously it wasn't an exact correct score, but the Squawker Talker score special coming up clutch. But it didn't come up clutch for Will, who is not here, replacing him, a man that I feel like I haven't spent any podcast time with recently, Sam Long. Welcome.
Thank you. How's it going?
Yeah, good, mate. And finally, Ollie. I bet you don't care that you got your prediction wrong.
Well, I did say Spurs would get something, which was more than most people did. I think everyone expected City to batter Spurs, which they did.
They did.
But Spurs won.
But they just didn't score. And Spurs ended up getting everything from that game. A 2-0 win.
And they Mourinho'd them.
They did. Although then there was critics that it wasn't actually a vintage Mourinho because they got so battered that any other time they won't win. But we're not doing review of Premier League football. We're doing a preview of some of the Premier League football. And there's only four matches this weekend, all on television.
Of course.
And it was announced last June that the competition chiefs had reached an agreement with the EFL and FA, allowing the Premier League to introduce a mid-season player break for the 2019-20 season. And you probably are all aware of that due to Jurgen Klopp's stance, shall we say, of not attending the FA Cup replay, which Liverpool under-18s ended up winning. The statement explained that the Premier League will split one round of matches in February over two weekends, with one set of matches on the weekend commencing 8th of February 2020, which is what we're going to be discussing today, and the other on the weekend commencing 14th of February. As I mentioned, all matches are going to be on TV. So, with the eyes of the world on all four Premier League games, we're each going to be talking about one, and we're going to go chronologically, which I don't usually do, but I'm going to stick to time this week. So we're going to start with
Not very
the
Chris
first...
Nolan, love you, Jake.
Pardon?
Not very Chris Nolan, love you, Jake.
Sorry, but I have to do it for this time. There's only four games.
Yes.
The chaos of four games on TV. Everton versus Crystal Palace, 12:30 p.m. on Saturday. Sam Long, the question I'm posing to you is, before we get onto your prediction that will be in the BetBall accumulator for 18+ and Gamble Aware, is... How have Everton actually been good since Carlo Ancelotti took over?
Well, I think first thing to say on this fixture is that we can expect a flat atmosphere at Goodison Park.
Brilliant.
Always seems to be the way when they play Saturday 12:30. I don't know if they have a heavy Friday night or what, but it always seems to take them half an hour to get into the game. But yeah, so Ancelotti has... I mean, it feels like he's still... only just joined Everton, but he's been there since Boxing Day. So it's a total of seven games. He's only lost once, which was, of course, against Man City. He's taken 14 points in that time. Only Liverpool have a better tally with 24, a ridiculous 24.
Perfect.
While Man City and Southampton have 13 apiece. So he's definitely got them on the up, even if their defence is still looking suspect at times, as we saw in the eventual win over Watford. And a win over Palace will actually take them up to the heady heights of seventh place in the table. That will be their highest position since game week four. You've got to go all the way back to the start of September for them to be that high.
When the table doesn't make any sense anyway.
Exactly, yeah. And they've only finished two game weeks, which was 20 and 25, inside the top half of the table since they reached that sixth place. So plenty to be positive about under Ancelotti, in that he has pulled them away from the relegation zone, which was his first point of call when he took over. So they're of course not the finished product, but it's definitely positives for them. Palace have hit some choppy waters. They've won just one of their last 10 games. Sole win against West Ham, so make of that what you will, because West Ham have been pretty pants themselves. They picked up good results during that time, draws against Arsenal and City, but they've dropped points against the likes of Brighton, Watford, Norwich, games that you would expect them to be converting into wins. Because if you look at their position at the table, if two of those wins are converted into wins, then Palace are sitting pretty in ninth. But as it is,
chasing European footballers, every club in the Premier League is sort of chasing at the
moment.
Well,
that's the thing with them. They really seem to be stuck in limbo. And I think one of the reasons why is because they've had another poor transfer window. You look, since they had the big sale of Wan-Bissaka, they haven't done anything with that money of note, really. No. Okay, so they addressed it a bit in January, their lack of goals, by bringing in Tosun.
A man notorious for
he's injured,
having one goal this season.
And he's ineligible because it's Everton.
Of course, yeah.
So it may well fall to poor old Benteke to shoulder
another
the...
Another man who's famously not scored in a long, long time.
Exactly, because Palace, they're the lowest scorers in the league now. 22 goals in 25 games, comes out at 0.88. Per game.
Make sure you wake up for this one.
Haven't scored 3 goals in a game all season.
Yeah. I had one to go along with that in 2020 they've only scored multiple times away from home against Man City. It's the only team. The last time they did it before that was in November against Burnley.
And now they're facing the might of Yerry Mina.
Well, obviously not in terms of scoring goals.
That's what I meant.
It's all right going against it, but they just have to be wary of him popping up for 2 minutes in two goals in what, two
stoppage
minutes
time.
Was it? Yeah, in stoppage time. So, yeah, maybe Everton are the team they need to play with that sort of.
Yeah,
because that's the thing about Ancelotti just there. As you said, only one team has won more points, but I've not ever switched on or looked back at an Everton game and thought, oh, they're doing well during that time that he's taken charge. And as you said, it still doesn't feel like it's been that long. And I mentioned as well, sort of off air, when looking at that time period, because obviously Arteta started at the same time, Arsenal got half as many points as that in the same time. And people are still saying, oh, at least Arsenal are playing, like, looks like there's a plan or whatever. But Ancelotti is just going about his business as he was expected to, picked up those 14 points and moved them away.
Yeah. I mean, as you would expect him to, we should say that, really. He's a very experienced manager. That is pretty much why they brought him in. But
They've had a decent run as well. And he's kind of just relied on like a nucleus of players. Lucas Dean's been really good recently, and Calvert-Lewin, obviously, he's gone off the ball a little bit the last couple of weeks, but he's been playing well. Holgate as well is really impressed. So he's got like a good core of players that are doing well.
Yeah, Everton's admin were doing the sort of Holgate stats with the cheeky England call-up line for it, so obviously impressing. And again, the young English players with England's centre-backs in general sort of being one of the most competitive positions in terms of there's not potentially a guaranteed starter. There could be
Gomez and Maguire are probably the two.
They're probably the two favourites, but even then, depending on what formations played, there might be a spare spot or becoming that dream backup centre-back for England that has been held by the likes of Lewis Dunk, James Tarkowski and the like, still up for grabs. Definitely a spot for the Euros available for someone that does impress in the back end of the season. But moving on to a prediction for this game then, unless you have any more analysis to throw our way.
No. So my prediction is that Everton are going to win by one goal. I expect Palace to score.
Do you?
I do.
So that goes against your analysis, potentially.
Well, I sort of put a bit of a theory together as to why they weren't, but they've got the joint fourth best defensive record in the league, which just sort of rammed home the point to me that you really can't predict what you're going to get from them.
Mm. So could likely be a 1-0, as it could be a 3-2 again, with Everton being quite chaotic under Ancelotti. But with no 3 p.m. Premier League kickoffs, of course, the next game you'll have to wait to watch is at the Amex Stadium, where, after looking at some of your notes and doing a bit of prep beforehand, Ollie, I've suggested the question as, are we going to find out what happens when two of the unluckiest sides in the Premier League play against each other?
Hopefully.
So you agree, two of the unluckiest side?
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, statistically, the sort of stats bear that out. Brighton have not been on a great run. They've won only one of the last 10 Premier League games, which is against Bournemouth on Boxing Day. And interestingly, since Graham Potter was given a six-year contract at the end of November, they've taken 11 points from a possible 36, which isn't the best return.
That's not helped with the people that are constantly clamouring for Chris Hughton to somehow return, because it was his form at the end. I always see tweets and people mentioning that, not clamouring
really
for his return.
He's popular, isn't he, Graham Potter, down there?
Yeah, I think with Brighton, but there's a lot of people that are perceiving the Chris Hughton should never have been sacked because they're just doing the same thing again.
Yeah, I do think with managers with a style, kind of get a free pass a little bit sometimes. I think Potter's really good, but
yeah,
points-wise, they're not picking up as many as you'd think. They should be, considering how they're playing.
Well, I was going to say, so points-wise, no, but hopefully you've got something here to suggest that I've not just pulled that statement out of thin air.
Well, yeah, I mean, they are struggling in terms of results, as we mentioned, but statistically, they haven't been that bad. So over the past 10 games, they've conceded 15, which isn't dreadful, and they've scored 12. So, I mean, they're losing. I think in that run, they've drawn 5, won 1, lost 4, and they've only lost one game by more than one goal. Mm. And that was against Bournemouth 3-1 a couple of games ago. And yeah, over that same period of time, only Man City and Man United have had more goal attempts than Brighton, which surprised me quite a bit. And also only Wolves, Southampton, Man United, Liverpool, Chelsea and Man City have faced fewer shots.
I don't know if you needed the only in front of that one.
But yeah, I mean, my point on that is that they've conceded 54 shots fewer than Newcastle over the past 10 games, and Newcastle collected one more point. So basically, they're not being as clinical as they should be in the final third. Obviously, they got three goals against West Ham, which should give them a bit of a boost in that respect. But also, they're conceding more than they should be in terms of how many chances they're conceding to opponents. Sorry. So they basically just need to tighten up. I think it's just small details.
They need a striker, isn't it, really?
Yeah, well, Glenn Murray scored his first goal of the season against West Ham.
Got himself
a
new deal.
So maybe he'll get a little bit of a run. More pace, strangely, wasn't used in that game.
Yeah.
He's gone off the ball a little bit. But they do have Trossard, who loves playing at the Amex. 3 goals and 3 assists in 10 at the Amex, compared to no goals and no assists in 9 games away from the Amex.
So one of those luxury players that you just need to...
He's a homeboy, yeah. He loves the Amex. And then on the flip side of that, Watford. So, Pearson, they obviously had a good bounce when he came in. In his first 7 games, they took 14 points from 21. They only lost to Liverpool in his first match in charge, which was also quite unfortunate.
I was going
to
say, they were really good in that game. Teams, if Saar was sort of settled and was actually hitting the ball, he missed that shot where it wasn't even a shot because he just completely missed the ball, wasn't it? But
interestingly, on Saar, since he's been injured, they've lost the last 2 games. I don't know if there's much of a correlation there, but he was one of their star players under Pearson in the first few games, and he's been missing. But yeah, I think with Watford, they've lost their last 2. And I think it just comes down to game management from them, really. And the Everton game was a case in point in that. They were 2-0 up, cruising in the first half, conceded twice in first half stoppage time from corners to Yerry Mina, as we mentioned before. And then they lost from their own corner eventually in the 90th minute. Everton countered on them and scored from a breakaway goal. And then against Villa, the other game which they lost recently, it was a 96-minute winner from Tyrone Ming. So last 2 games, they've really been sloppy in conceding points. In fact, this season, they've lost 15 points from winning positions in the Premier League, including 6 from the last 2 games. And they also managed to chuck away a 3-0 lead against Tranmere as well in the FA Cup. So this is a bit of a worrying run for Pearson, I think, in terms of how they're just not managing games at all. They're still playing good football and attacking well, but defensively, they're conceding sloppy goals.
They need to start getting players sent off again. I think it's first 3 games they had players sent off, and Tranmere was the only one that they'd failed to win, and obviously that came back to haunt them massively because Tranmere went through and then obviously dispatched quite comfortably by Man United. But just in terms of the points since Pearson as well, his first game, Everton, Southampton, Man City, Liverpool, the only teams with more. And Brighton in that time, I know it's a convenient period because it's with Pearson as well, but Brighton have the joint fewest in that time with 7.
Yeah.
and Norwich have 7, West Ham and Crystal Palace we spoke about have 8, hitting that rough patch, and then Arsenal, as I mentioned, compared to Ancelotti, Arsenal and Newcastle on 9 at that point. So Watford, over the course of Pearson's time in charge, have obviously performed much better, and probably, I don't know if they've fully escaped the relegation scrap yet, but considering how dire it
still
looked,
19th. Yeah. I mean, going back to the unlucky sort of aspect of it, only Man City, Liverpool and Leicester have scored more goals than Watford since Pearson came in, and only Liverpool and Sheffield United have conceded more. So he is doing a good job, but I think it just shows what a mess he inherited when he got there, in terms of Sanchez Flores' return was an absolute disaster, and Gracia didn't get off to the best start either. So they have been getting a decent number of points, but it's still not enough to have taken them out of the bottom three. But there's only 3 points between the two clubs going into this weekend. Brighton are 15th, Watford are 19th. So
6-pointer.
Yeah, it is a classic relegation 6-pointer.
And your prediction for this 6-pointer then is surely going to be exciting, fascinating and full of intrigue.
I think it will be a good game that will end in a point apiece.
So draw.
Brighton love drawing.
They love it.
They
can't
love
get
it.
Enough of it. Well, you only need 38 points to
stay up, lads.
You only need 38 points to stay up is the cliche. Yeah. So if you drew every single game, then you'd get exactly that.
So that's the West Ham went down on 42 points one season, but
yeah. I didn't say it was every season. I said that's the cliche, Ollie. Don't use facts against me here. I do that. So a draw.
Yeah, it's one of those games that literally anything could happen. I wouldn't be surprised, but yeah, Brighton love drawing, so maybe we'll go with that.
So we've got a close Everton victory early on Saturday, and then a draw. But it could be a 9-all. Could be.
Yeah.
We just need a draw for that to come in. And then we move over to Sunday, and Mo's chomping at the bit, but you chose the latest game, so I've got a button here.
The anti-Christopher Nolan.
Sheffield United versus Bournemouth, Sunday 2 p.m. I won't dwell too long, as you've heard my voice already. So this is the game I picked out, and it was, when I was doing my research for this, I went to head over to look at a brilliant Twitter account that if you don't follow and you're interested in Sheffield United and the stuff going on there and people watching every game and analysing every player, then Blades_analytics is where you need to go. Give that person a follow. They're also a recruitment analyst for Peterborough United, so you get more than just this Sheffield United stuff. So I went over there, but before I'd made that journey, looking at other stats, I noticed that David McGoldrick, who famously I think has had the most shots in the league without scoring a goal, has actually missed all 15 of his big chances in the Premier League this season. And of the 27 players to have missed 10 in Europe's top 5 leagues, he's the only one that hasn't scored at all. And 25 of those players have scored at least 5. And Luke de Jong is there with 2 scored and 12 missed. And then, as I made my way to the account, Blades Analytics conveniently put together a graph which showed the quality of chances created per shot and the general conversion rate of each team. And without the actual graph and the risk of not boring everyone with a sort of deep dive on this, it was really interesting because David McGoldrick's stats there were also, in essence, a microcosm of Sheffield United this season, who obviously are having a brilliant season in 6th place. We noticed that we mentioned that the points in that sort of mid-table were so close that they could easily drop out with 2 bad results, but perceived to be doing very well and, of course, expected to be in a relegation battle. So they're doing enough to be well outside of that. But Sheffield United are actually operating at a below-average conversion rate in the Premier League, despite creating some of the best chances per shot. They're not shooting loads, but they're creating good chances, but they're not finishing those chances, as mentioned with David McGoldrick there. Poor David McGoldrick. 0 out of 15 is quite a stat, I thought, when I came across that. And they're playing Bournemouth, and Bournemouth are almost the inverse of that in the sense that they have a lot of shots. They're not very good shots, quote unquote, because I know some people can get a bit tetchy with the expected goals metric, and we saw that recently with the Spurs win against Man City. But in general, I think it's a good indicator of one of the players they have in Harry Wilson, who throughout his career has been known to score spectacular goals that shouldn't be scored by the normal human being. So there was a microcosm of 2 players here, one that is getting so many good chances served up for him through good work of his own as well, but missing them. But Sheffield United have been good enough elsewhere, especially in defence. Dean Henderson joined most clean sheets, I think, in the Premier League this season alongside Alisson. So they don't need to score as many, whereas Bournemouth, who have been perceived as struggling and usually could rely on scoring a lot of goals with Callum Wilson, Josh King, Harry Wilson came in and started really well for them this season, are perhaps not creating good enough chances, frequent enough, to actually fire themselves up the table. So my prediction for this game, based on that, is that I don't think both teams will score, because I think either way this table is going to right itself, and Bournemouth will have loads of shots from outside the area, and Dean Henderson will be laughing, lapping them up, catching them and rolling it back out to the overlapping centre-backs to stream forward. And Sheffield United will either score or not score, and Bournemouth will get one of Harry Wilson's spectaculars. I think David McGoldrick is injured for this game.
He's been out for the last few games.
Yeah,
I do feel quite bad for him as well, because everyone knows he hasn't scored, but he did actually score against Spurs in one of the most contentious VAR decisions of the season, when John Lundstrom's big toe was offside and it took like 4.5 minutes to disallow it. So if that had counted, maybe he would have gone on.
He'd have one scored, 14
missed. Maybe he'd have gone on a huge run of goal scoring form.
But it is a confidence boosting, isn't it? And so unfortunately, I wouldn't have advised to put David McGoldrick to score any time as the prediction.
Good odds, though.
You'd get good odds, but the stats suggest that he's not going to be scoring anytime soon, rather than scoring any time against Bournemouth. But in general, Sheffield United, who the team isn't changing that much. I know they've finally bought in a few players. Maybe we'll see some of those January loan signings that we mentioned on Monday's podcast. Retsos could come in as one of the defenders to give them a break. Rodwell, we haven't seen too much of in the Premier League yet. And obviously Zivkovic could be playing up front instead of someone like David McGoldrick. So I think we'll see, as I said, this match pits against two teams that they're not issues, but they're trying to score in different ways. So therefore, I think it will be quite fascinating. And given Sheffield United's statistically should be the preferred way to try and score goals, I think they will. I think they'll come out on top, and I think it will probably be a 1-0 win. But to be a bit safer and to try and get one accumulator over the line, I think I'm going to go for both teams not to score for that one. The final game.
Yes.
Here you go. You've been waiting patiently.
Very patiently.
Man City. Manchester City on the back of not scoring in two games for the first time under Pep Guardiola face West Ham at 4:30 p.m. on Sunday.
Yeah. West Ham haven't kept a clean sheet versus Man City since November 2012. And City have won their last seven matches against West Ham by an aggregate score of 23-7. Wow. So, how can I put it this way? They're going to smack them around. They're going to smack them senseless. This is they've been held out of it by two games. And this is the thing. They've played in the last two games City haven't scored. They've played well in both games. Mm. That's the thing. They created chances. They looked fluid. It wasn't like they just had two bad games where they didn't perform. They look really good. They should have scored. You're thinking, how did you miss that? How did you miss that? How did you miss that? And it's all going to come to a head now. I mean, they're missing Raheem Sterling, and Sterling scored three of their last six against West Ham, got the hat-trick in the 5-0, and then, so...
But is this a... I'll interject there.
Go on, then.
Raheem Sterling has not been in great form recently. Yeah. So, given that he's perceived as one of Pep's most important players and is probably one of the people that in the forward line you can guarantee to be starting, is it a blessing in disguise and a chance to try something new out for the Real Madrid game with him not playing and potentially not being available for that against a team that Man City usually find a way through against regardless?
Pep is 8-for-8 against West Ham. Like, he's won every game. So, and only Malaga and I think it's Watford is he got 8-for-8 against. Like, he's always beats them. So yeah, I agree. I think this is the perfect time now to try something different, because I think 4-3-3 doesn't really work with no Sane or Sterling. It's not going to work.
Sane's training though again.
Yeah, but he's not going to. I don't think you can rush him back for the Real Madrid game. I mean, Bernardo plays well on the right. Mahrez plays well on the right. I don't think you can play either on the left. You can maybe play Foden on the left there, but that's a lot to ask of him to play that role. And with Mendy, I don't know where he is or if he's ever going to play. You know, so you can't. So I think they need to switch to a 3-5-2. I think they've toyed with it a few times this season and it's worked. I think that gives you multiple things. First of all, you can get João Cancelo into the side with Kyle Walker, so Cancelo's defensive problems aren't going to kill you as much. Zinchenko playing wing back makes more sense for him than playing fullback. I mean, it just does.
He'll be suspended for this West Ham
game. Yes, though. But I think looking forward, you could play him. If you're playing wing back, you could even play a winger there. So against West Ham, especially, you could maybe put Mahrez or Foden there. Even really, if you're playing West Ham.
And if you're playing West Ham, stick anyone there. Just put Sane out because you won't need much pace to get past Zabaleta at the moment.
Oh yeah, just having limp past him. You don't mean to downplay West Ham or not, but they are pretty rubbish.
They're struggling.
They're really struggling. They're looking bad, and they've got a horrible run of games coming up. I would imagine that they will be well in the relegation dogfight once this run of games is over. I don't think so. They're struggling. I think City, three at the back. Two things. The key thing for three at the back is you need to get Walker in defence, because one thing that Laporte doesn't have, which is why Van Dijk's. I've said this before, but the reason Van Dijk is clearly superior to him is the fact that Van Dijk is fast. But you could put Van Dijk in any defensive system and he'll make it work because he's got pace as well as everything else that he's got. And Laporte doesn't have pace. Kind of like PK, doesn't have great defender, but doesn't have pace. So in your high-line system, you need someone with pace next to him or you're going to get killed on the break every time. For me, you put Walker in defence, but Walker's not a defender. But then if you play three at the back, you put Fernandinho, Walker and Laporte is a good back three. It's got a good mix of experience and quality. You've got your one star centre-half in Laporte. Walker can then, and you're thinking ahead to Real Madrid, Walker's now then one-on-one with Hazard basically the whole game, but with the cover of Cancelo as an orthodox right-back and then two centre-backs as well. Mm. And that, I think, is the dream scenario for Real Madrid, for Man City, because Real Madrid have been prepping Hazard's return for the Man City game. They're not bothering him with La Liga.
They don't need to. They're top.
Well, exactly. They're taking their sweet time with him. And Hazard, and this is the thing, Hazard has caused Pep massive problems before. Mm. He's changed his entire game plan to counter Eden Hazard before, because Hazard does so well. Conte's, what was it, the Cup Final, League Cup Final? Was it FA Cup Final? Sarri, sorry.
I think.
Yeah, and then Sarri, in the League Cup Final, just basically said, okay, sit back, punt it to Eden, we'll be in the game. I mean, they were in the game.
Oh, yeah.
Because Hazard was so good.
Sensational.
And he played City all by himself. So he can do it against Man City, we know this. So, I don't want to dismiss West Ham, but I do think City will win this game easily. I think prediction, City are going to win by two goals or more. Goals. But I think looking at Madrid, this is where they've got to try and plan something. Because they're not going to have Sane, they're not going to have Sterling. Those are huge losses. So maybe they play 3-5-2. You could put Aguero up front with either Jesus as well as a duo, or start him with Mahrez, and then you can bring Jesus off the bench if you need to. Because you've got three men in defence, it enables you to put Bernardo Silva in midfield without worrying that you're going to completely kill yourself in transition, because you'll have Rodri, De Bruyne, Bernardo Silva, lots of creativity, not as good solid defensively, but then you've got three centre-backs behind them, so it's not as big of a deal. It allows you to shut down Real Madrid's full-backs, which is a huge source of creativity for them. They're Carvajal and Marcelo or Ferland Mendy on the overlap. You can go man-on-man with them, and you've still got a guy free, Kyle Walker, to deal with Eden Hazard. That's a lot of things, because Real Madrid aren't necessarily a really potent side right now in terms of scoring goals.
No.
But
they're just not conceding.
But then if you add Eden Hazard to that, suddenly
balance.
Yeah, there's an ability for them to just sort of springboard forward and really be dangerous in attack. Now, of course, Hazard coming in for someone like Vinicius is going to hurt them defensively a bit, but they'll gain so much more offensively. So it's easy to look at Madrid now and thinking, yeah, they're not scoring that many goals. City maybe could contain them, but they're getting ready to get Hazard back. Mm. And that's going to be a game changer for them. And then, scoring against Madrid, it's not going to be easy, but the way City attack, you think?
Well, you say that, and I just think Real Madrid, based on what I'm seeing from them in La Liga, 13 goals conceded, the fewest in Europe's top five leagues, are the sort of team that could end up frustrating Man City, because in their last two games, obviously, 180 minutes, 31 shots and no goals. Obviously, that must end. And this is why you almost feel sorry for West Ham, because there's no way, surely, that can extend to three games. And it wouldn't surprise me if Man City only produce seven shots but score five goals.
Yeah.
I think that's similar to what happened when they spanked Watford. It was after the Norwich defeat, and then there was just a clinical cutting edge, because this is at the Etihad, if I'm right, well, which they're usually
expect a reaction.
They're usually brilliant there,
yeah.
In terms of swashbuckling attacking play, as you said, no Sterling, so the debate of shall I start Aguero, that decision's already made. Potentially, Aguero, I think, has got a really good record against West Ham, as he does pretty much every Premier League team.
12 and 16. against them.
So not bad.
Two in the last two, although they're both penalties, but you know,
still. Well, they need someone to take them
as well, considering the goals they gave up against Brighton.
Yes.
I mean, if they're that sort of generous at the back again this weekend, then it could get up.
And exactly, you mentioned when we were talking about the Brighton-Watford game, Brighton not being on good form, but that the mental aspect of the game of coming back. And yeah. I know they drew again, but not losing and actually saying, right, we can score goals quickly and save a game. The inverse of that is West Ham are thinking, we were 3-1 up.
And cruising.
And cruising.
All over Brighton.
And we still couldn't convert that to a win. And then going ahead, how do you turn up against Man City and try and sort of quell them? Who were, as you said, Man City are going to be angry.
I think, honestly, if Sterling hadn't gotten injured, West Ham would have more of a chance. That sounds really stupid to say because Sterling's so good. But I just think it would have been, Pep would have played basically the same system again. Mm. And maybe they're not in good rhythm. Maybe it would have been another frustrating evening, because you can see Moyes has frustrated Pep before. I mean, I think Pep's first game as a Man City was like a 2-1 win, only with a penalty over a Moyes team. So you could see Moyes maybe frustrating him. But I think the fact that Sterling's gone means Pep's going to have to, he's going to have to change something. You can't play 4-3-3 without Sterling. So I think that's going to give City new life, new energy, new thrust, which is important because, like I said, looking ahead to Madrid, that's a much harder draw now than it looked when it was made. Because Madrid have hit some form, their defence is really in rhythm, Courtois playing brilliantly. And on top of that, they've got the talent to score a goal here or there, and they might even have Hazard back. So,
as bad as West Ham have been, though, I think Man City would be making a big mistake if they are just 100% focused on Madrid.
I don't think I'm looking on Madrid, but I don't think Madrid, I think West, they'd have to look at West Ham. They have to get there first, like, to get to Madrid. But I'm saying, because Pep has to change something, he should change it with, not just with West Ham, but with Madrid in mind as well. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not just like, if you have to change something for West Ham, okay, I'll just put Phil Foden at left wing, or put Riyad Mahrez left wing, and we'll probably have enough to get by West Ham anyway, because it's West Ham.
And what's the difference between Jared Bowen and Karim Benzema anyway? Prepare for one and you prepare for the other.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Because we might see Bowen's debut.
We might.
Again, back to, as you said, West Ham's games.
Yeah.
If he doesn't score in the first five games, it's going to be like, oh, he hasn't scored. But it's the teams they're playing is... Like, he would do well to score in all of those games in his first Premier League season.
The only one you'd say, yeah, okay, maybe you should score against them is Arsenal.
Come on. Another clean sheet.
That's true. Arsenal. That's true.
You just don't have to worry about Arsenal scoring against you at the moment. But anyway, they're not playing. Stop mentioning them. We've done all of the Premier League preview. You reckon a 2+ goal Man City victory for that? We'll be putting this on the BetBall app after the podcast. Follow Squawker Football on there. And join us if you dare on this accumulator, or maybe just pick your favourite ones and make your own. After the break, we're going to be crossing over to the continent to pick out 4 more games you should be watching this weekend. Excitement of spending more time than usual on some fixtures abroad, I forgot that we'd penciled in something closer to home. Again, the leagues that I forget exist.
Shame on you.
I have to be reminded. In all seriousness, the first game that we are going to talk about is Nottingham Forest versus Leeds United in the Championship, because months ago, you would have been forgiven completely to assume that West Brom and Leeds United would be automatically promoted to the Premier League, no trouble at all. But the table as it stands, West Brom 56 points first, Leeds United 55 in second, Fulham 52, Nottingham Forest 51, Brentford 50, Bristol City 50, and Preston North End 47, Swansea 46, and then it tails off a bit more. So all of a sudden, perhaps you have the solid six that are in contention for... Perhaps that may be locked in. But in terms of automatic promotion, it's almost anyone in that top sixes to grab from the clutches of Leeds United and West Brom. So, Sam, is that going to begin this weekend with a Forest win?
Well, we were definitely talking before Christmas, in the run-up to Christmas, that Leeds and West Brom were going to run away with it, which so very rarely happens in the Championship. And then back then, Forest were well off the pace, 11 points behind Leeds on Boxing Day, but now it's turned around into a proper title race and the competition for the playoff places. I know you mentioned it there. I think it's 10 points between first and eighth, but then between sixth and I think down to something like 13th, there's another sort of 10-point gap. Mm. So even teams who don't look like they're in the playoff picture at the moment could put a run together and be up there. Leeds are 15th in the form table for the last 10 games. They've taken 12 points from an available 30 with a goal difference of minus one during that time. When you consider that their overall goal difference is plus 19 and still the third best in the league, that's a huge drop-off. And their home form has definitely contributed to the dip. So I'm wondering whether the fact that they're playing Forest away will actually help them. But it's so difficult to predict what's going to happen with Leeds, because just as they seem to have taken a step in the right direction when they came from behind to beat Millwall, they go and lose to Wigan again, like they did last season.
I was going
to
say Wigan was the at Elland Road, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The sort of fixture that undone them last season.
Exactly. Momentum's definitely been lost for them now, and they desperately need to regroup, because you can bet your bottom dollar that other teams around them in the table will be looking at Leeds knowing that they can get at them, because after Forest they've actually got Brentford and Bristol City. So within 2 weeks you could be looking at Leeds not even being in a playoff place. It's got that bad for them. So it's a real tipping point, and you just feel that they have to get over the line this time. Of the teams that have come down from the Premier League, Huddersfield and Cardiff, not the biggest of teams. You would say that they were there to be got at compared to some of the other teams that could be coming down this season, say a West Ham or a Watford. Mm. So Leeds are approaching not dire straits, because obviously if they turn it around now, it's still very much in their hands, but another couple of weeks of not getting back to it and they're going to be right in trouble.
And you wouldn't sort of trust them in the playoffs given the form again, would, especially as you said, like even the home advantage not necessarily telling the full story. They need to just get that automatic promotion so that they can write it off and there's no more concern, because I think a few more interviews came out from players, and I can't remember specifics of it, but the similar to the Spurs interview after their recent win against Southampton in the FA Cup, with Dele saying, "We deserve a trophy. I know we have to win one, but we deserve one." And I think Leeds United were saying, "We deserve to be promoted."
Yeah.
And people are saying, that doesn't mean anything.
Like, no,
you
no.
won't get it being just like, make it to the point where you deserve it beyond people mathematically being able to chase you. Because as you said, they were in a commanding position. They're still 3 points ahead of Fulham in third, but given their form,
well,
and with the result, a potential bad result this weekend, that's swallowed up in an instant.
But so not just them, so not just Forest, sorry, with Brentford and Bristol City to come, another two who are banging form. Bristol City won 4 on the bounce, could go 5 this week, and then the gap will have disappeared. Stephen Lamucci came in and took over from Martin O'Neill, and was a bit of an unknown, even though he's had some big jobs. Took the Ivory Coast to the 2014 World Cup, but has been out of work since he managed Rennes in Ligue 1. And he's done a great job. They're in danger of losing a few players during the January transfer window, but they held on to Matty Cash. Jack Robinson went to Sheffield United. But I think the big one for them is getting in Nuno Da Costa from Strasbourg. I can't say that I've seen a lot of him, but just getting a striker in was so crucial, because Lewis Grabban was their only option really up front, and okay, he's hit 16 goals, but the squad depth is so important. I remember when he first took over and he said that amongst other things that Championship was the worst league because it was difficult, but he also described it as a marathon league, and that's really where we're at in the Championship season. These are the marathon miles, and Forest seem to have hit their stride just at the right time, where sort of
themselves.
Leeds seem to be suffering from cramp and falling away at the wrong time.
We said this was off air again when we were discussing topics. Is this the legacy of Marcelo Bielsa?
That's what he does.
In the sense that teams, for whatever reason, and as I said hesitantly, I've seen a lot of people contest the idea that they simply run out of energy or they're unfit. But they obviously play a demanding side, and it's happened more often for there to be some sort of...
Call it physical, call it mental exhaustion, whatever it is. The players routinely collapse at the second half of the season, and it's not like the tactics change. You know what I mean? And it's just like the famous one, I think, maybe for a lot of listeners, is the Athletic Bilbao side 2011-12 were sensational to watch. They had a barnstorming 2-2 against Barcelona in the wind and rain. They absolutely smashed Man United to pieces. And everyone was like, this team are going to roll over everybody. By the time they reached the Europa League final, Atletico Madrid, Diego Simeone's Atletico Madrid just folded them up into a, you know, scratched them into a ball and threw them in the bin. It was 3-0 Atletico Madrid. They were just never in the game. Just never in the game. And they lost the cup final as well to Pep Guardiola's Barcelona 4-0, 4-1. So every time they get to the end of the season, and you know, whether it's mentally exhausted from what Bielsa puts them through, whether it's Bielsa's own, I mean, he's always very self-critical, so maybe it's even Bielsa himself is like, he loses his nerve. But it's just, when you watch Bielsa, you always get the sensation if he played with robots, he'd be the best manager in the world. You know, it's just, his tactics are fantastic, but it's just...
He needs to sign Erling Haaland then.
Well, this is another thing that Leeds fans obviously love him, but one criticism I think they have of him is that it takes ages to implement any new signings into his side because his tactical instructions are so precise and so unique in a lot of ways. It takes new players a while to sort of understand what exactly he wants. So they brought in Jean-Kevin Augustin from Leipzig, who supposedly Man United were interested in
is quite random. They couldn't convince him late enough to sign.
He decided to go to Leeds instead. But he hasn't featured yet, and Leeds fans have been on Patrick Bamford's case for a lot of the season. He was starting ahead of Eddie Nketiah when he was on loan from Arsenal, and he had a great goals to minutes ratio but wasn't getting any starts. And it looks like Augustin is sort of in a similar sort of boat, but yeah, that's another thing that maybe he needs to sort of bring him into the fold just to freshen things up a little bit.
Yeah, so someone so wedded to their philosophy, almost too rigid in the sense. And that, I saw the recent report about Pep Guardiola. There was sort of one, you know, they came out really late from their dressing room after the Spurs defeat.
Yeah.
And there have been a lot of reports, and obviously none of this is sort of official or we know it's definitely happened, but some mentioned that the players were starting to get slightly frustrated at the constant tinkering and the constant changes to the lineup rather than developing any consistency. And with those perfectionist managers in which they can't, if something goes wrong in one game, trying to fix it and identify what went wrong and changing is intense for the players. And when you get late into the season after you've already played 40-odd games, 30 games, it's harder to then implement rather than being fresh at the beginning.
That's definitely what allegedly happened at Bayern Munich under Pep. And then, of course, what's funny is they replaced him with Ancelotti, and within like 6 months, they're all like, we want Pep back, bring him back. Because Ancelotti was so much the other way, where it's just like, hey guys, chill, it's cool.
Yeah.
We're all friends.
We're just going to get... Well, that's what's happened at Everton, chill. Yeah. We're just going to get 14 points. No one's going to notice.
Yeah.
Only Liverpool have got more than us. And it's like, what? How did it happen?
And it should have been 16 as well, that Newcastle game, where they lost two goals in the 95th and 96th minute.
Crazy. So... Leeds, again, you're going to have to be watching a lot of football to watch all of them, but that's definitely an interesting fixture if you do get the chance, because Nottingham Forest could completely tear up that race for automatic promotion. And Leeds, again, we could be seeing the exact same thing we saw last season. We're going to now actually go over to Europe. As I said, I got a bit too excited first. And the game we're going to start with first is in Italy. The Milan derby is taking place this weekend. And Antonio Conte has put together a Premier League tribute act with Christian Eriksen the latest to join. Four of them started in Inter Milan's recent win. Alexis Sanchez came on and Eriksen went off, which means that we didn't see Victor Moses, Ashley Young, Christian Eriksen, Alexis Sanchez and Romelu Lukaku all on the pitch at once. We might see it against Milan. Against two Lions, which he didn't want me to say. Ollie rolled his
eyes. Goodness sake.
Because I was working on it. Obviously, Ibrahimovic missed AC Milan's last game, but looks like he'll be fit. And then Rafael Leao, which translate to Lion, could feature, but we don't know. But I just wanted to say two Lions.
Yeah, well done.
Cheers. Yeah. What do you expect to happen, though? Because Inter Milan obviously chasing Juventus still. And AC Milan, a sort of resurgence since Ibrahimovic joined. Again, that sort of mental advantage of someone that knows how to win and knows how to score goals coming in and their form has matched.
Yeah, they've been in good form. I think they're unbeaten in 2020, and I think they've got the fourth best points return so far in Serie A. They've got 11 points so far this calendar year, and Inter have only got 9. Obviously, Inter are second, 3 points off Juve, and AC Milan are down in 8th. But they're 7 points off Atalanta in 4th. Mm. So they could conceivably make up that ground. But yeah, as you mentioned, you know, the battle of the ex-Man United strikers, I think, is a good place to start in this one, in that Romelu Lukaku's brace against Udinese at the weekend took him to 20 goals for the season. That's the fifth time in the last six seasons that he's managed that. Only last term did he get under that in a sort of indifferent injury hit season at Man United. And then for Milan, Ibrahimovic has got 1 goal in 4 Serie A games from 15 shots, which isn't the best conversion rate, but he's got 2. He's also scored in the Coppa Italia, so 2 and 5 overall. He missed the 1-1 draw against Verona at the weekend through injury, in which Milan had 26 shots and drew 1-1. Verona had 10 men for the last 20 minutes as well, after Sofyan Amrabat got sent off. So Ibrahimovic was absent for that, but he's back in training and will probably start, I think, if he's fit enough to do so. He's played 90 minutes in his last 3 Serie A games, so he's been brought in to be a starter.
Yeah. Well, they sold Piontek as well, so they got rid of that sort of goal scorer, you will. And Ibrahimovic has come in and said, move.
Yeah,
I'm playing up front.
I think he's got 5 goals and 7 against Inter as well. And he got, I mean, this is going back nearly a decade, but his last game against them, he got 2 goals.
continue the streak.
But yeah, we were talking about Milan's top scorers off air, and I didn't even realise this. Jake brought this up. But Teo Hernandez, the left back, is their top scorer with 6 goals.
Yeah,
it's quite dire. In all comps. So wow.
He's one hell of a player, though. That's
the Milan fans love him. Yeah, but that kind of just shows where Milan are at, really, in terms of they are picking up results, but they're just, you know, 1 goal from 26 shots against Verona sort of encapsulates it all. They're just not clinical at all. So Ibrahimovic has a big game on.
Whereas I think Lautaro Martinez will be back as well after, I think he got 2 yellow cards for his spat.
I think he's still suspended.
He might be suspended, okay. So we definitely could see the 5 Premier League players all on
Sanchez,
one pitch.
Sanchez came on. He's been out, obviously, for 3 months, but he's been brought off the bench in the last 3 league games, I think. Inter started with Esposito, 17-year-old kid up front, who's very highly rated, of course, but Sanchez came on for him in the last half an hour, which is the most football he's had for... 4 months. And apparently his cameo was quite good as well. So
he won the penalty, which Lukaku converted as well.
So he might be given a run out. Christian Eriksen didn't have the best full debut. He was hooked after 58 minutes.
What a surprise you brought that up.
And Conte said he's not fit enough for Serie A. He said, obviously, he needs to get settled into our style of football and also find the right fitness levels for Serie A. But I'm very pleased with his full debut. So wasn't too bad. 14% Jules won, though. Not great.
Ollie spent 45 minutes digging for something after Ericsson's quote saying...
The fitness thing is interesting because, I mean, isn't there the quotes about Lukaku where he didn't realise he had a stomach condition or something, like, you know, and because it went United and didn't realise it. Came to Inter and was like, and the Inter doctors were like, hey, you've got a problem, mate. You need to adjust this and adjust that. Mm. And he's dropped all the weight that he had at United that was slowing him down. So it's like, I mean, apart from being a scathing indictment of how useless Man United are at everything... you know, it could be that under Poch, because he'd been there so long, things weren't as ship-shape as they used to. Maybe Eriksen is a bit unfit. Maybe he does need just more time to just get into shape. Conte famously demands his players to be in ridiculous shape.
Conte's demands of players in general
Pretty
and the board
sky high.
And the director and the club he's at are usually pretty intense. So
yeah, and Eriksen's naturally one of the fittest players in Europe, probably. Yeah. I mean, we've spoken about his durability before. So it'll be interesting to see what midfield 3 Conte goes with. Eriksen, Sensi and Barella are the sort of 3 headline players in there. But it's very technical midfield 3. Conte has often had an enforcer, you know, just a solid guy that will put himself about, win tackles and things like that. Like people like Vidal, Kante as well. Barella probably has the most profile of that kind of player, but...
I think that when they signed Lukaku, we did a little video on their tactics and looking back at what he played with Juventus, and then Alexis came in, we were like, oh, that's the Tevez. You've got the goal scorer. And then obviously they had Pirlo at the base of it, and he seemed to have used... Brozovic is probably the Pirlo And then the Barilla and the Sensi are meant to be those more dynamic midfielders in front, like me personally.
Yeah.
But as you said, you don't. Where does Eric, is Eriksen all of a sudden going to become an Andrea Pirlo? Or
yeah, he doesn't seem like a massive Conte player. I don't know, but obviously having signed him when he's would have been free in 6 months, they want him. They wanted him straight away as they're going for the title. But yeah, Brozovic is the guy that I think a lot of Inter fans want to see in the side. But so it's just who does he come in for? He came off the bench against Udinese because he's been injured. Mm. He should be fit to play.
And he replaced Eriksen, didn't he, in that
game? Yeah, yeah.
So, interesting composition to see for Inter Milan. As I said, I want to see all the five Premier League players on just so I can use that.
Daniel Maldini for Milan, then? That'd be nice if he could get a turnout.
Continue yeah, it so it's not just a tribute. Because now they've ticked him off.
Three generations of Maldini.
Yeah, it's only the 2000 and the 1970s where Maldini hasn't represented AC Milan. So they've ticked it off for this decade now. They can just wait.
I actually feel a bit bad for Christian Maldini, Paolo's other son, who was at Milan's. He was in Milan's youth team as well and didn't get his token gesture appearance.
And that would have completed it if they managed to bring him on one game.
They messed up the stat as well.
We wouldn't have a hole in the Maldini timeline. Just a final word. Obviously, we've picked out Inter versus AC Milan because there's not Premier League games on. Whereas it's almost an interesting discussion to say, I know this is quite a Premier League-focused podcast because it's what we know the best, but you could even make an argument that we may have not have given Milan Derby the full discussion treatment.
I don't think we would, even though a Maldini is going to be involved. I think it says a lot that it used to be one of the most sought after, looked forward to games on the European calendar, and it's become very missable now.
And now you've got Stefano Pioli's eighth placed Milan. It's almost like another game for Inter Milan. Like, you watch it to see if Inter Milan can close the gap on Juventus, not for the actual derby. And Icardi, who usually lit up these Milan derbies in recent seasons, isn't even there. So it's whether Lukaku's going to... I think he scored in his first one.
Lautaro is always worth watching, but he's not going to be there.
Yeah, exactly. If he's still suspended. I think Lukaku, you picked out... Didn't you say there was a stat about him scoring in two games?
If he scores in this one, he joins a very illustrious list of players to have done it.
Foreign players
to have scored in the first two derbies, but I can't remember the whole list. Ibrahimovic is on there, Jorkaeff, Ronaldo, Milito. It's a very nice list.
So that's the main reason to tune in, is to see if Lukaku can keep silencing the critics and try and catch Immobile for Golden Boot, which I think is going to be a tough ask considering Immobile is on 25 now. We'll move on to Mo's mastermind subject next.
Beards.
No, not beards. Sorry. Mastermind football related subject. Because Barcelona
Barcelona, you mean?
Despite having the return of tiki-taka football, finally we've rid ourselves of Ernesto Valverde. Off the pitch has become even more chaotic, with Ousmane Dembele being injured again, a reported hamstring tear. Eric Abidal coming out to say that a lot of players were unhappy and not working hard under Ernesto Valverde, and that they'd been planning the sacking since the Clásico. And then Lionel Messi responding to that by saying, I don't really like to do this, but as one of the most influential players in the world, I'm going to post it on my Instagram story. I think that when you talk about players, you should give names, because otherwise you're tainting everyone else's name and feeding rumours that spread and are not true, which almost sounded like, if you're going to
say it with your whole chest, Eric.
Lionel Messi has been reported as one of the people that backed Ernesto Valverde and supported him, necessarily didn't want him to be sacked, but that is all, of course, up in the air. No official confirmation there. All of this chaos that's going on off the pitch.
Yeah.
They face Real Betis next, obviously Quique Setién's former side.
Yeah.
So despite what's going on off it, is the on-pitch development or lack of a reflection of this chaos, or is there some positives if you're watching from a purely football perspective.
No, if you're looking at the football, it is a massive improvement, like under Valverde. And I think part of the reason why Messi was so vociferous in his backing of Valverde, oh, Valverde did nothing wrong, it was us, the players, we failed, is because Valverde just played him all the time. Valverde played him and his mate up front all the time, every minute, every game, they were fit, never took him off. And it was just like, why wouldn't you back a man that did that? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, if you're 32 and this guy, Valverde basically conjured a formation, 4-4-2, where neither of them had to track back, and they could just spend the whole game, Messi and Suarez up front, attacking all the time. Now, functionally, you allow Messi that freedom because he's the best player in the world and he gets it done for you. Suarez, as I've spoken before at length, diminished physical ability, couldn't really perform on the same sort of consistency level, but was always up there nevertheless. Why wouldn't Messi back in? Now, under Kike Setien, there's a lot more work involved, a lot more tactics involved. It's a lot different, you know. And so, it's not like...
And they don't have Suarez.
Then that's Suarez, yeah. That problem has been solved for them by his injury, although he's rehabbing quite ferociously. And I mean, the funny thing is that they almost need someone. They need a body.
Oh.
No, not him, necessarily. They need a body because Ousmane Dembele just can't... Just so unlucky. He'd just come back. He'd been in Qatar, working. He's gotten really hench. It looked like he was really trying to make a go of things, and then he's got a hamstring tear, needs a surgery, probably going to miss the rest of the season. And it's just heartbreaking for the kid, because I mean, it's easy to point about, oh, he's a flop, he's this, he's that. The fact is, he's basically spent over 50% of his time as a Barcelona player injured. Like that's you can't develop like that. He joined them as a 19-year-old, 20-year-old. Like, he's not barely played enough to develop. And when he has played, for the most part, he's looked functional, but in need of coaching, which he hasn't been able to really get. Partly because of Valverde, partly because he's been injured all the time. So it's, yeah, but Barca as a whole are progressing. They're moving in the right direction. They start off with this 3-5-2 formation, which was really risky, but because Barca got rid of Todibo in a hurry, they don't have the defenders to play that system. So they're playing Sergio Roberto right back. Valencia diced them up completely because you can't play Sergio Roberto as a right side of the back three. It's not going to work. He can't even play right back. Why could he play? Why would he play that formation? So he's back to a 4-3-3. Now they look a lot more solid. Nelson Semedo's back in defence. Now Semedo's a much better player than Sergio Roberto. So now you're seeing a bit more defensive solidity. The midfield is starting to look a bit better, but really they need Arthur to be fully fit to really sort of integrate him in. Busquets is still looking good. Frenkie de Jong is coming along. He was rumoured to be one of the people that was unhappy with Valverde, which I can understand really, because if you come from Ajax, where you've been trained, drilled by Erik ten Hag really hard in systemic football, you come to Barcelona, it's just a bunch of 32-year-olds just hanging about having a laugh with Valverde, then you're going to be like, what the hell is this? So he's probably really appreciating the new focus on training. And it's looking good. Up front, they're shallow up front. They've got three forwards and that's it. They've got Messi, Griezmann and Ansu Fati. All playing well. Messi and Ansu in particular. Messi, this is the funny thing. Obviously, all the rumours now are going to be about, oh, how he's not happy with Kike Setien, or he's this or he's that. In the last, since Kike Setien's taken charge, Messi has the most shots in La Liga, 22. Most shots on target in La Liga, 12. Most dribbles, 17. Most chances created, 9. Nothing's changed. He's only scored one goal, but that's just his shooting boots. Like, in the last two games against Valencia, 22 shots. Most of those came in the last two games. That's the funny thing. Like, that he's just been absolutely pelting shots at goal and just not had his shooting boots on. And another day, he would have bagged hat-tricks in both those games and it'd be like, oh, Messi's fantastic. So it's just, on the pitch, they're progressing. They're basically having to start all over again, because this is the change that I've been advocating for they should have made in the summer. And then they would have been doing this, what they're doing right now, like you said, in pre-season. Do you know what I mean? Whereas now they've sort of like, cut the start of the season all over again, basically, because it's like, but what Valverde is doing, what Valverde was doing, what Kike Setien is doing, completely opposite.
But it all results in Messi having loads of shots.
Because who else is going to have loads of shots? Like, this, you need to work on it, you need to improve on things. I mean, Messi having loads of shots is a function of, that's just Messi, right? But you want to have more people having more shots. In the last game against Valencia, it was just Messi having the shots. Last game, Ansu's had 5, I think. So they're stepping up. They're trying to get, with the 4-3-3, they're getting more people more involved. If Griezmann was a bit more assertive, which I mean, he'll probably grow into playing as a 9, they'll start making shots. But look, there's obviously problems going on at Barcelona. Abidal is speaking against the half the squad. Like, if you're going to address rumours like that, address them full on. Like Messi says, just be forthright with it. Don't like be coy about it, because then.
But he can't come out. He can't come out and name drop Lionel Messi.
That's what Messi's saying. Like, if you're going to do it, or just don't do it all. Basically, why would you even bring it up if you're going to say, oh, some of the players are like this? Because
to send a bit of a message to the players without publicly naming them, I think, is what he was trying to do.
It's a risky gambit, though, because
it is when you've got players like Messi who wield so much power at Barcelona, which I think is what it's proven really.
Yeah, it's...
And also, is it not the... Didn't fans want to hear that they were trying to get rid of Valverde than everyone thought?
That's fine, but it's the fact that you then say that, oh, the players were unhappy, the players weren't training, because the players have all publicly backed Valverde. So when you just come out and say, oh, they weren't trying, you make them all look like idiots, because they've all been repeatedly saying, no, Valverde's fine, because you don't want to turn against your manager, ideally, right? Even if privately you believe he should go, you don't want to publicly come out and say, oh, he needs to go. So... It was just a strange move from Abidal, and I feel like it's backfired on him a little bit. I don't think they'll sack him purely because he's still too useful as a PR shield, because he's a very likeable guy. Everyone likes Abidal. And I think ultimately this board are so comical, there'll probably be another mistake they'll have to sack him for in the summer to make him be the fall guy for. But it's weird because honestly, he did fail to get a striker in January, and Barca arguably needed someone. Like they're in for Rodrigo, and that sort of fell apart. And they never signed a striker. I think they needed a winger more than a striker.
Abidal recently name dropped Aubameyang, Cavani.
I mean, Aubameyang would have made a ton of sense for. just if you look at, I mean, not for the money Arsenal would have wanted for him, which would
exactly.
have been
exactly. So it doesn't make any sense.
As a player, that's the kind of skill set they should have been targeting. What I thought was funny was that we want a nine, like this one, Giroud, and like Barca.
Oh, that was the other one he mentioned.
Yeah, Barca don't need like a big number nine. That what they need is a winger. They need someone with pace, because right now there are only two wingers. One of them is injured, one of them is 17 years old. You can't play a 17 year old every single game week. It's not fair on him. So, but they're going to have to now, or they're going to start bringing Alex Collado. There's rumours they could get an emergency loan in to replace Dembele. You can do that in Spanish football. If you have a player out for like the rest of the season, you can basically use as a clause, you can sign someone from outside the window. I think only from within La Liga though, I think.
Yeah, I don't know too much on that.
They should have been looking at Dani Olmo maybe more seriously. We'll talk about him in a minute, I think. But there's definitely still work to be done at Barcelona, but they're moving in the right direction. They're playing in the Copa del Rey against Athletic Bilbao. Tonight is the day of recording on Thursday. Who knows what actually happens in that game? Setien definitely has them moving in the right direction, and they're getting themselves together ahead of Napoli in the Champions League. It's kind of weird because both Napoli and Barcelona had really weird, dodgy starts to the season, and they both picked themselves up now. Napoli are playing in decent form now under Gattuso. They're finding their rhythm a little bit.
After an awful start under him, not just in their form anyway. And they obviously beat Juventus, only the second team to beat them this season. But I still think, again, like we said with AC Milan in eighth, Napoli are tenth and quite a far adrift.
So it's not like they're blistering form all of a sudden, but they're improving. I think Barcelona are finding their rhythm as well. And I think that replacing Valverde when they did was not ideal, but I think it's necessary. I think that they're slowly, even with all the nonsense around the club, and that's going to run. My guess is there'll probably be elections in the summer now, because last time Messi had a
strop,
an Instagram strop. If you remember back at the start of 2015, when he and Luis Enrique had a falling out, and he had a little Instagram. He liked a couple of Chelsea players on Instagram and followed Chelsea on Instagram, and everyone started going,
That doesn't mean anything, though.
No. But that was perceived as this big sort of signature. And then literally after that happened, Xavi pulled Luis Enrique together. They had a meeting and they formed MSN.
I don't want to spend any time on liking Chelsea Instagram.
And then there's elections in the summer. So I think there'll be elections at Barcelona in the summer. But
so
they could beat Betis. I think they've got Betis are good. Not great.
They're not Setien's Betis anymore.
No, they're not. But they're still pretty good. They're still all right. But I think Barca will have enough firepower to take them down.
Right. The final game then that we picked out was a top-of-the-table Bundesliga clash, because it seems that whatever happens, Bayern Munich just end up top of that table in recent years. They face RB Leipzig in that. And the Bundesliga title race in general is really close. Dortmund are still very much there. Gladbach, I think, are still fighting for it.
You wouldn't rule Dortmund out with their new boy, would you?
Exactly. If someone's scoring with every seven goals with every eight shots they have, then they are someone to look out for. But defensively, Royce injured. You never know if that's going to happen again. Similar thing. We're talking about Leeds following a familiar pattern. Borussia Dortmund, remember, were leading the Bundesliga last season. Royce got injured. Form went downhill. And Bayern Munich win. But a new challenger steps up this season. The Squawker Scout's curse seems to have struck Timo Werner, since we made the video on him saying how brilliant he is after he was the first player to score 20 Bundesliga goals. RB Leipzig are on a three-game winless run, and he hasn't scored. But
Sorry, Timo.
Yeah, sorry about that. But Bayern Munich, again, always linked with them. Potentially this is the game where he sort of reminds everyone that he's going to be one of the most sought-after strikers in Europe. And obviously is contesting Robert Lewandowski for the Torjäger Cannon. I think that's how you say it. Which this season is going to be, you're going to need a pretty high tally to get it, because Lewandowski won it last year with 22 goals and he's already hit 22 this season and Werner's got 20. So Bundesliga top two, and they're the top two for shots, top two for goals, top two for touches in opposition box, and top two for big chances missed. So prediction wise I went for not both teams to score in that Bournemouth Sheffield United game. I think both teams are going to score in this. Leipzig, I've only beaten them once in the Bundesliga, but Nagelsmann, new team, new signing, Dani Olmo potentially. I mean, he scored
in his first start, didn't he?
He's a real potential game changer in attack. His dribbling can really destabilise opponents. Mm.
But the sort of unsung hero potentially is should have been Arsenal signing Christopher Nkunku, who has created the most chances for RB Leipzig in this season, rescued a point against Gladbach with an absolutely stunning strike. Has really come into his own, and Emil Forsberg, who was the elite creator of the 2016-17 season, slowly finding it more difficult to get into Nagelsmann's side, with Sabitzer on the other wing performing really strongly, and Leipzig changing between about four formations, 3-5-2, 4-2-2-2, 4-4-2 flat. So he's not finding his way in the team. Timo Werner is the main man that they need to get the most out of from the RB Leipzig side, but I just wanted to focus on two Bayern Munich players specifically, because Thiago Alcantara, who I feel is the ultimate final boss for any midfielder. If you can play against Thiago Alcantara and have a good game, or he doesn't dominate you, then you can say I'm a pretty good player as well. And in recent games, he's been in incredible form once again. You never know if he's fully fit or not playing. He doesn't seem to play 30 games a season.
When
he plays, he's unreal. And he's actually scored in three consecutive Bundesliga games, which is probably unrivaled for him. I didn't go back to check, but that in itself is impressive. In those games, he's completed 13 out of 15 take-ons, dances around pretty much anyone he plays against, is always really high for dribble output and dribble success rate, 50 out of 57 this season. Incredible ball retention, elite creation. I think that's going to be really interesting, because the double pivot with Joshua Kimmich that has emerged now as the favoured partnership in a 4-2-3-1, whether it's Coutinho that plays a number 10 in a creative role, or Goretzka plays as a number 10, the more goal-scoring threat for Bayern Munich. They've settled on a formation now and, as I said, picked up form, find themselves top of the Bundesliga again. And then Thomas Müller, who we always seem to have an argument about, not an argument, we always have the discussion and pose the argument of whether he maybe needs to be given less game time. In the second half of the season again, and I had a theory that all of the best players and all of these older players actually discover their best form in the second half, mainly based on Ronaldo, who's now turned 35, scoring in every game in 2020, just as when the Champions League restarts. Thomas Müller has found a similar vein of form, and since they beat Borussia Dortmund 4-0, and including that game, he's directly contributed to 13 goals in 10 appearances, and has only not scored or assisted in one of those. So, joint assist
since Flick came in, he's been brilliant.
Yeah.
Kovac just didn't fancy him at all, did he? And he also got dropped from, he got retired by Jogi Löw for the German national team. So both his managers just weren't interested in him anymore. Flick's come in and he's suddenly firing again.
But Flick, who was obviously with Jogi Löw a lot during Germany and in the 2014 World Cup, obviously know Müller and perhaps has that sort of, I don't need to build a Germany side. Because the thing with Müller, it's not that he's not very good. It's that he represents the old guard, and there's very much this emphasis in modern football that you should be constantly moving on and developing a new team. And under Kovac, I think he was asked to try and do that. Koeman was playing on the wing, Gnabry was playing on the wing, you had Goretzka playing as the number 10. Thiago didn't feature much. This Bayern Munich team now is almost
Hummels got moved out.
It's hard to incorporate Müller into sides as well, because where do you play him? He's not a winger. He's not a number 9.
He's a Ramdeuter.
He's not really a number 10. And you can play him as a number 10 if you sign Coutinho and you want to play him, and Lewandowski loves it when you play Coutinho, then where do you play Müller? And
Lewandowski loves it. Thomas Müller's the joint assist provider in the Bundesliga. He obviously loves it when Thomas Müller plays.
This thing, Müller is such a class player. You've just got to find a way to put him in the team all the time. Pep always did when he was in charge of Bayern. It was always
that's 6 years ago.
Yeah, but even now, though, I think he's still quite. I mean, we're seeing the numbers. You're seeing how good he is right now. If you find a way to get him to the team. Also, with Müller, he's the kind of player that I think reflects the overall health of a side. if that makes any sense. So when a team is playing well, Muller thrives because his thing is moving into spaces, moving off players, and he makes a good team better. If the team is perhaps playing poorly, short of stabbing in some scrappy goal or something, Muller's not necessarily going to lift the side because his greatest skill is playing off other players, moving into spaces, being available for 1-2s, wall passes. That's how he gets so many assists for Lewandowski. And if the other players aren't doing their part of those things, then what he can do can almost evaporate. Do you know what I mean? And I think that's why he does so well in possession-based teams, because everyone gets more involved that way. And
I think the injury to Coman and Gnabry's, again, struggling with a bit of fitness, meant that they returned to this sort of, let's play all the 28-year-olds that have been playing football for years and know exactly what to do. Perisic, remember, they got on loan a sort of front three behind Lewandowski at times is Perisic, Coutinho, who is experienced, and Thomas Müller, which is completely different to Goretzka, Gnabry and Coman. So maybe the fortunate of changing the manager gives him the opportunity to say, right, let's return back to basics a bit, let's pause on the complete redevelopment of Bayern Munich for a moment, and let's just win the Bundesliga again first and then try again in the summer. We still don't know if Flick's going to be the long-term manager or whether this is just a project. But in terms of the irony, and I think the Bundesliga mentioned this in their comparison between the two teams, there's a massive irony in the sense that Flick, who's been around for a long time, as I said, alongside Jogi Löw for Germany for 100-plus games, is actually the least experienced manager on the touchline, despite going up against 32-year-old Julian Nagelsmann.
How is he 32?
Exactly. Man? Younger than Lionel Messi. And at least Nagelsmann's not posting stroppy Instagram posts about his team and his new signings. So it should be a brilliant game based on, as I said, they're the leading scorers in the league, the leading shot takers in the league. Expect some goals.
I'm really hoping that Leipzig can just give it a go, because I remember the big Bayern Dortmund game, I think last season, 2 seasons ago, and Bayern just wiped the floor with them. I think it was the last season, there was a game Jadon Sancho didn't play, and I was like, we got hooked off like half an hour.
That
or
was
something.
This season.
Yeah, and it
that
was just
that was the four.
Yeah,
because he was playing rubbish.
Yeah, well, he was, but that's my point. I really hope that Leipzig can just give it a go, because like that game was so disappointing, thinking, oh my god, here we go. They're going to beat Bayern, it's going to be great, and it's going to be
it was
really
all in the first half, wasn't it? The goals. As well.
And last season as well, when they were top, and I mentioned the sort of implosion of Dortmund, they lost 6-0 Bayern.
Yeah,
Bayern are the home team again, so it's, a new challenger, and the final boss midfielder has actually found some form, and Thomas Müller again.
Word on Alphonso Davies as well, the best ever TikTok.
Yeah,
not that I've seen many TikToks, but I've seen it on Twitter.
Yeah, whatever.
And it was TikTok unbelievable.
Yeah, incredible.
His Backstreet Boys rendition.
It was, and that means that he
look it up.
He's now earned a place in the recent under 21 combined 11 we did on Squawker, because I put Hakimi there first because Davies is playing left back, and I just
That's why he got in.
No, he's
TikTok
not in.
Ability.
No, I'm not. He's not in. I'm saying
that's fine. That's fair enough.
His PR has gone through the roof after that TikTok, so now we're just getting loads more people saying that Davies should be in.
Got ya.
TikTok.
Everyone loves a Brooklyn Nine-Nine reference.
Yeah, right? And he is left-footed, and I'm always a proponent of matching your fullbacks with the correct feet, but I just thought Hakimi's so good, and I needed Trent Alexander-Arnold in the team as well.
Hakimi's a machine.
But you have to wait to see Hakimi the machine in more action, the PSG Dortmund tie in the Champions League, which we'll be obviously previewing or reviewing very soon, will be one to keep an eye out. But for now, thank you for everyone for our Premier League preview and European/Championship. Championship is now on the continent, according to me. Thank you all for joining us. Thank you all for listening. Look out for the BetBall Accumulator on the app, and we'll see you next time.